Shalom uvracha. This is Rabbi Nachman, Rabbi Neil Winkler, with the third in our series of recorded lectures of my Jewish history class entitled History is His Story, a class I've been giving in the Israel Center of the OU for the past 5 years, and which, due to the circumstances, I now have to put on recording, hoping that there are those who are tuning in, the students, the attendees to the class over all these years, so that they do not miss the lectures that I would be giving on Tuesdays at 12:15. As I said, this is the third of these lectures, and I recall that we left off the last lecture trying to understand the popularity of Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shmo Zichro, and how he rose to power when we, with 2020 hindsight, cannot at all figure out what the attraction was and how he rose to such great power to cause such horrible pain and suffering to so many. He was, as I may have mentioned last time, a very gifted orator. He could speak for hours, and throughout the time, the masses were absolutely mesmerized. He was very charismatic. He was almost hypnotic in his speaking. He was extremely energetic. We are told that he slept no more than 3 to 4 hours a day. And, as also we mentioned last time, he had this concept that he was chosen by God, and he was, therefore, a God-like persona. He was, as he would call it, an Übermensch. He believed he was greater than others, and that he was meant for greater things than what he was simply before, a painter or a soldier. Beyond that, we're talking about the early 30s, where the primary source of communication was the radio. And he exploited the radio for his publicity, especially once the radio, the state radio, was under his control. He used it as he wished. Now, that was done also by others. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had his fireside chats throughout the 30s and the 40s and during the war, so that it was not unknown. The difference being is that these speeches of Hitler were broadcast around the world. Before this started, in, again, late 1920s, Hitler attempts to overthrow the government. This is his second attempt. The first one failed. The second putsch, as it's called, also known as the Munich Beer Hall Putsch, was supported not simply by his followers of the National Socialist Party, which still was a small party, but it was now supported by General von Ludendorff, who was a hero of World War I. And he took with him other army officers. This granted more legitimacy to Hitler and to his views, for there were, of course, many, if not most, in Germany who really did not think him to be more than a radical and a fringe element not to be taken seriously. However, the army officers, the militarists, supported him because they saw in his promises the ability to rebuild the German armaments, and to once again place the military, and especially its leadership, in a leadership role for the whole country. This putsch fails also. And during that putsch, the attempted to take over in coup, 11 of the Nazi followers were killed. And yet, the very ringleader who organized it, Adolf Hitler, was never punished. Once again, this merely encouraged him. And now he begins to gather followers. He gathers thugs and criminals, what we would perhaps call the goon squads. He organizes the SA, or the brown shirts, SA standing for Sturmabteilung, meaning storm troopers. It was a paramilitary organization, which he did not himself think of. It was rather fashioned after one of his heroes. His heroes, Benito Mussolini in Italy, who had his own small army called the Black Shirts. He now has the Brown Shirts. He designs his salute, which has become infamous by now, and the swastika. And he does things that people like. He gives jobs. He gives jobs to the unemployed. How does he get the support for this? How does he get the jobs and the money for those jobs? He's financed by industrialists, great industrialists of Germany, who were going, as the entire population was, through a recession, a depression actually, looked to revitalize their businesses and their industries. And they see in Hitler the type of leader who could do that. But they also knew that he wasn't completely normal. And they therefore attempt to control Hitler by supporting him and figuring that they'd be able to take care of him. It's during this time that Hitler survives an assassination attempt. Not the one that took place in the 40s. This one took place in the 20s. And he survives that, although it partially paralyzes one of his arms. Now, once again, Hitler sees this survival as a sign of divine providence, even though he denied a god. But he certainly was once again convinced that he was made for greater things. Now, we also find that in 1926, the party runs. He does very poorly, only 7% of the vote. But by 1928, the economic crisis and the depression, which paralyzed the economy and the government, impacts the vote. Clearly, as we mentioned before, they want quick fixes. They want instant coffee. And Hitler provides that solution, at least the promises. He provides the solution by simply finding scapegoats. The Jews are those who are to blame. It is they who caused us to lose World War I. It is they who, after all, benefit from all wars. They are not patriots of any country. No matter who wins or who loses, he would say, the Jews always win. And he points, of course, to the same canard that they've been speaking about for 50 to 100 years in Europe. When a country goes to war, it needs capital. Well, the biggest banks in Europe were the banks of Rothschild. So whether Germany would win, or whether France would win, whether the Axis or the Allies, the bank will always win. They lend money to everybody, and therefore they get wealthy. And he uses this canard, this lie, to provide the people with a scapegoat. The Jews are scapegoated, and Hitler becomes the savior. As a result, by 1928, Hitler gains between 13 and 14% of the vote, which is significant. But by the next election, in 1930 now, he has over 20% of the vote, and he begins to feel that power is within his grasp. He sets his little army, the SA, the brown shirts, he sets them free into the streets. They begin to riot, to destroy, to attack. the government is powerless, or at least too frightened to react. In the Reichstag itself, the Nazi Party representatives attack and they pummel political opponents. There are fist fights in the Bundestag, the Reichstag, actually. Hooliganism in the parliament itself. They terrorize, they cower their opposition, even though they are still a minority. And the government lets it happen. No one felt strong enough or courageous enough to speak out. They were terrorized, which is exactly the plan that Hitler had. And once they let it happen, soon it could not be stopped. Soon it becomes inevitable. 2 years later, by 1932, and the next elections, Hitler runs for chancellor. And again, he is defeated. But he gains, or the party gains, some 35 to 40% of the vote. This is no longer simply significant. This is headline making, and this changes history. Germany faces now the choice. Do they want Hitler, or do they want a civil war? The chancellor at the time was a man by the name of Franz von Papen. He was a very clever, almost sly financier. He attempted to appease Hitler, but Hitler could not be bought. As a result, he forces Germany to the brink, the raging battles in the streets almost every night. Thugs begin to attack Jews wherever they are, and the German Jews really do feel physically threatened, for indeed they were. The legal system, the police, the courts, etc., they actually helped the Nazis. They failed to enforce law and to arrest the perpetrators. It's hard for us to understand. If I'm repeating what I had said last time, I do so to bring you up to date and let you understand that as soon as Hitler takes power, the stage is set for persecution of the Jews. As early as 1933, on April 8th, the Nazi government declares a boycott of the Jews. The professionals, the doctors, the shops, they are closed. On May 10th, a month later, they burned books that was written by Jewish authors and any books that were written, as he would say, in the Jewish spirit. Even the poetry of Heinrich Heine, which was written 100 years earlier. And leading the book burning, the ceremonies, was a man known as Joseph Goebbels. Goebbels was a minister of propaganda. Jewish civil servants were fired. Jewish lawyers were barred from court. Jewish professors were dismissed from universities. 8 science Nobel Prize winners became refugees, including Albert Einstein. And Jewish musicians were banned from orchestras, including the greatest, recognized as the greatest violinist of the time, Bronislaw Huberman. Now, if that name is somewhat familiar to you, perhaps you would recall, you know, of the Huberman Auditorium in Tel Aviv, but it was he who moves to Palestine, and he establishes the Palestine Philharmonic Orchestra, soon to be, of course, the IPO, the Israeli Philharmonic that we have today. And he built the orchestra, and this in itself is a fascinating story, and I only touch upon it here, by convincing the great Jewish musicians who were under Nazi rule and had no job, really, to take their families to move to Palestine and to join the Palestine Philharmonic, which becomes the great orchestra that it now is. Hitler promised the people that he would take the wealth away from the rich and return it to the poor from whom it was taken. And of course, there is a definition for rich. The definition for rich was Jews, and the poor were everybody else. President von Hindenburg could no longer hold out, and he appoints Hitler as chancellor. He too thinks he would be able to control him. And it is the industrialists and the militarists who are those supporting this view and telling him to make him the chancellor. All those who wanted order, control, supported Hitler, and under the threat of violence, they couldn't turn them down. The opponents in the Reichstag were beaten to death, literally. They cowered in surrender, and they didn't show up to vote. The SA took over the streets, as I mentioned before, the brown shirts. The Reichstag is abolished within 6 months, and Hitler begins to enforce his program. His program consists of the following. A, he wants to abrogate the Treaty of Versailles. That was always a stain on the German population, on their ego, on their view of themselves. He wants to do away with that horrible treaty, and he hoped to do so without any military intervention, without any war. He believed he could do so with threats and with bluffs because he correctly understood the Western mind. He did not want war at that point. He didn't want war for the Jews, he didn't want it for Czechoslovakia, and not for Austria. And in effect, that's exactly what he did. He destroyed Jews without a war. He marched into Czechoslovakia by having peace. And in his time, as Chamberlain, who signed that paper, called it. And he, the Anschluss, which we'll get to, when he marches into Austria. No war. The threats and the fear, he takes over. The second thing he looked for is to solve the Jewish problem. He wants the Jews out. And in fact, he keeps the borders of Germany open for them to emigrate for not a month, not for 6 months, but for 6 years. And then eventually, when nobody else wanted them, eventually he comes up with a plan to destroy Jews. And the third thing for him was to eliminate unemployment, to put Germany on a wartime footing. This unites the workers, unites the industrialists, as I mentioned, and the militarists. It makes Germany a formidable military force, despite disarmament of the Versailles Treaty. Despite the agreement and the Treaty of Paris, that they would no longer rearm themselves, Hitler laughed in the face of those who signed the agreement with him and went on his own way, pushing and pushing until someone would stop him, and nobody did. He also built upon the nationalistic feeling, the power thirst that was there, and it was there since the 18th century. In March 1933, a new player comes to power in the world. His name is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, voted as president in November of 1932, replacing Herbert Hoover, who was, by the way, a very fine individual, but has been blamed for the Depression and has an perhaps unfair view of by most people. Hitler is obsessed with Roosevelt. He sees him as his natural enemy. He actually does believe that Roosevelt is Jewish. Now, ironically, the Jews also believe that Roosevelt was their savior. Hitler was wrong, and the Jews were wrong. Hitler boasts when he takes power that I will build an empire, a Reich, that will last 1,000 years. His Third Reich lasted 12 years, but it unleashed unprecedented misery and destruction upon the entire world. At this point in time, it behooves us, I believe, to take a little break from Europe, Germany, and even from the Yishuv in Palestine. And instead, since I mentioned it just now, I think we have to take a look at Franklin Delano Roosevelt and FDR. And the truth of the matter is that when lecturing on the topic of Roosevelt and the Jews, when we tried to study the actions of this United States president over the years of the Holocaust and even before, from when he took power in 1933, he took the office until his death in 1945, we find ourselves really faced with a challenge of great difficulty, in my humble opinion. Can we, after all, reveal the real attitude of FDR through his pre-war statements alone, a time when Germany was a trading partner of the United States? Or should we judge him by the statements he made during World War II, when Germany was an enemy of the United States? Do his actions speak louder than his words? Or perhaps none of these really reflect his true attitude, his personal feelings, only his executive decisions. Were they based upon the welfare of the country? Was that most important for him? And the truth is, again, the study is complicated by the great regard that Jews of that generation had for the president. He was seen as a close friend of the Jews. At the time of his presidency, his liberal tendencies accorded with the Weltanschauung, which the world view of the vast majority of American Jews. I tell you my own personal experience. I cannot recall in my youth, admittedly I wasn't politically savvy, but I couldn't recall any Jew who was a Republican in the 1950s and the 60s, perhaps except for Jacob Javits, that I recall was the Republican senator of New York State. Javits, by the way, is the name Javits, is his, the Yiddish name, his Hebrew name. Javits was the great rabbi, Rav Yaakov Ben Tzvi, known as Yaakov Emden, and he was a direct descendant of him, hence he got the name Javits. But even as late as the 90s, older members of my kahila in New Jersey spoke in reverent terms about FDR, and they would not stand to hear anything negative about him. That's the impact he had on many Jews of the time. And, truthfully, that reverence was understandable. He had a Jew in his cabinet, Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of Treasury. He had a number of Jewish advisors as well. He was close with the judge, Louis Brandeis, and the Harvard professor soon to become the Supreme Court judge, Frankfurter. But decades after his death, historians began to question his decisions and even accused him of anti-Semitism. The publications that came out are vast. Early ones, Arthur Morse's book, Wild 6 Million Died. More recently, David Wyman's The Abandonment of the Jews. And there was the great book by Breitman and Lichtman, FDR and the Jews, who gives a more positive view and defense of Roosevelt. And a recently published by Madoff, The Jews Should Keep Quiet. Now, additionally, the writings of the contemporaries, especially Morgenthau's diaries of his discussion with the president, they shed light on the decisions of that time and the reasons behind them. Furthermore, it's essential to realize that the America of today is not what the America of 1935 was. In 1935, there were strong views of anti-Catholicism, anti-black, and anti-Semitism. They were very common. It was a time when the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, was active in many states. A liberal, such as FDR, found these movements to be an anathema to his view of an American democracy. And he took care not to take any action that would possibly rile up these feelings across the country. And so he said to Jews who encouraged him to speak up or to act decisively against Nazi tyranny, he would tell these groups that he feared that citizens of the United States, who generally at the time were isolationists, they were reluctant to get into what they called the European conflict, that these people would claim that once the war would begin, FDR was fighting a Jewish war. A painful reflection of anti-Semitism during FDR's time, and only one of many, took place in the Congress itself in 1941. A vicious diatribe by Congressman John Rankin of Mississippi accused international Jews of trying to drag America into Europe's war. And that diatribe, that speech, caused a Jewish congressman, Michael Edelstein of New York, to suffer a fatal heart attack. This was a time when, according to the polls in the late 30s and 40s, more than 50% of the United States population perceived Jews as, and I quote, greedy and dishonest. Between 35 to 50% in these polls felt that Jews had too much power. Remember, only 20 to 25% said they would sympathize with a campaign that would support a widespread campaign against the Jews in the United States. In fact, one third of the public regarded Jews as overly aggressive, and shockingly, 15% are the ones who said they would support a widespread campaign against the Jews in the United States, and 20 to 25% said they sympathized with such a campaign. Only 30% said that they would oppose it. Remember, this is what America was at that time. Besides all of this, you had 3.5 Americans listening to a weekly anti-Semitic sermons of the vicious Father Coughlin. For this reason, understanding the background now, much better idea, most influential Jews also refused to speak out against the Nazi outrages. And more often, they supported Roosevelt's approach that it was best for Jews to remain silent. There were Jewish congressmen. There was William Serovich, Emanuel Seller, who actually was supportive after a while claiming, or more correctly, of damning the Nazi administration and their outrages. Samuel Dickstein, Adolf Sabbath, Saul Bloom, these are all members of Congress. And most of them, certainly in the beginning, in the early 30s, were reluctant to criticize the president. And while Sabbath and Bloom were in the forefront of defending every one of Roosevelt's actions or inactions, some of the Jewish congressmen eventually became opponents of the attitude that FDR was showing. I could continue with many more examples of the opposition or the indifference or the fear, but I believe I've described for you the atmosphere in the United States at that time, and as I tell over and over again, we are students of history, and students of history cannot fairly make judgment upon what happened years ago. We weren't there, we don't understand. And therefore, it's really not right to criticize. However, we do have to know and understand. Despite the anti-foreigner, anti-Semitic culture that pervaded America at the time, it still doesn't explain or excuse much of the president's decisions and actions. Questions that arise and have been brought up before. Why did he refuse? Why did Roosevelt better agree to deliberately suppress immigration from Europe at a time of the most need? Why did he decrease the quota far below the limits set by United States law? In doing so, he left 200,000 places unfilled. How many Jews could have been saved if those numbers were higher, if those places were opened, or better yet, were filled as legally they could have been? Why did the president refuse to admit Jewish refugees to the Virgin Islands, which, part of United States territory, was not part of the 48 states at the time? Why did he refuse to allow the empty Liberty ships? Let me explain to you, those who don't know. The Liberty ships were ships that had brought troops over to Europe for the fight, for the war, and they returned to the United States totally empty. They were empty, and he was asked to let refugees get on those ships and save their lives, and he refused. Why? And of course, the great question raised by Arthur Morse and others before him: why did President Roosevelt reject pleas to bomb the railways leading to Auschwitz and save 10,000 lives each day that the trains would not run and could not bring the Jews to the death camp? It is perhaps unfair to judge these actions in 2020 hindsight when we know the full story of what happened during those years and what impact, therefore, his decisions ultimately had. But I believe it is fair to wonder about his motives. Why did he make so many decisions that were inimical to Jews and Jewish interests? And they are decisions that predate the Holocaust and World War II. There were decisions that were not political in nature. For example, Roosevelt, as a member of the Harvard University Board of Trustees, voted together with other members that the board should limit the number of Jews that would be admitted to the school, a Jewish quota for Harvard University. Or perhaps the seeming indifference to Jewish insensitivities and Jewish suffering. When judges Henry Morgenthau and Felix Frankfurter visited the White House in September of 1933, which is the very beginning of Hitler's administration, they asked Roosevelt to publicly decry Nazi persecution of the Jews. FDR refused, but he promised that he would say something about human rights abuses in Germany. And yet, he did not. Even this he refused to do. I want to pause here, and we'll continue next time with the questions we have and trying to understand the motives, but more than that, getting to understand what was happening at the time and what the Jews and how the Jews were suffering here in the United States because of their inability to move the president. What that means for our history is clear. What that will mean for FDR's eventually, and it's still going on, but how he stands as a moral light is also going to be defined. Please God, our next class, we will do just that. Have a good week. Have a healthy week. I wish you all a refuah shleima for those who are sick, and a return to the shigra, to the usual way of things, bekarov, as soon as possible. Thank you.